This week on the IoT podcast. This week on the IoT podcast.
I'm Eric Bowman, and for the last 5 years or so, I've been at TomTom. Last several years as the CTO, and I would argue that TomTom is an IoT business in lots of ways. Almost 25 years ago, I worked on the original version of The Sims computer game.
Many hours spent on that, Eric, and were you to blame for that? Yeah. Is it beyond just what people used to know of TomTom? That was the, you know, personal navigation devices that used to sit on top of cars' dashboards, or does it go further than that?
TomTom had an Internet of Things business before Internet of Things existed. Early in the devices, they started putting SIM cards in and collecting GPS probe data. In a very simple Internet of Things application and uploading that to a server and creating a traffic model, which allowed people to avoid a traffic jam. As people experienced that for the first time, it was really a kind of hair standing up on the back of your neck moment, like an absolute triumph of product and technology.
What are your thoughts on where we are with IoT at the moment?
AI has been quite literally transformative for many people. I think it's quite possible that it's actually going to be what enables something like an IoT breakthrough in the market.
Not long ago to now getting to the point where the AI could start to converse. Now, if you take that other dimension of being able to converse and or think for itself based upon the data that's coming, it starts to get quite spicy and quite interesting.
I think it's moving now faster than it's ever moved. What a time to be alive. Amazing and terrifying all at the same time.
We're talking about the leap of AI. We've got quantum computing obviously growing at a rapid pace as well.
Yeah.
IoT actually now, you know, doing its thing and not being theoretical anymore.
I'm a little more skeptical about quantum.
Okay, I'll be interested to know why.
I mean, obviously, full-scale quantum is kind of scary because it will render much of the encrypted data in the world currently in the world unencrypted, essentially. And the consequences of that are a little scary.
Welcome back to the IoT podcast. I'm your host, Tom White. Every week, we are joined by the biggest names in IoT to unravel the trends, misconceptions, and predictions for the Internet of Things. Before we get into today's episode, don't forget to subscribe on whichever platform you're watching or listening on, and turn on that notification bell so you're never out of the loop.
Are you getting the most out of your IoT device data? Could you be making better decisions? In today's episode, I'm joined by Eric Bowman. Eric's the former CTO at TomTom, and we're going to discuss the interpretation of IoT data and how to make the most informed decisions based on it. We'll also explore the skills needed for IoT development and the challenges faced for this year as we see further convergence with different technologies, including AI and quantum. Let's get into it.
Eric, hello. Welcome to the IoT podcast.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. We were saying just backstage, actually, I think this is the first time we've ever had anyone on the show that's not directly, and you'll probably argue this slightly with me, but directly being involved or on the tin from an IoT perspective. But clearly your background and where you've been is very, very impressive. And we're delighted to have you here. So for people that don't know you, Eric, could you give us a quick intro on who you are and how you got into this world?
Sure. Thanks. Yeah. And I think that can only mean that IoT is breaking into the mainstream now.
Yes. Yeah. Finally.
Finally. I'm Eric Bowman. And for the last 5 years or so, I've been at TomTom, last several years as the CTO. And I would argue that TomTom is an IoT business in lots of ways. And we can maybe talk about that more. But it's also, you know, like any business, really focused on delighting customers with amazing experiences, which is the only place I ever really want to work. Before that, I worked at Zalando, which is a fashion e-commerce company based in Berlin, and was the first VP engineering there and oversaw a significant kind of cultural and architectural and leadership transformation that was called Radical Agility. And that helped kind of around the time they went public, helped position the company, I think, really to be more like a tech company than just a retailer. In the past, I've worked for other e-commerce companies and Telco 3 in the UK and a startup in California. And a long time ago, like almost 25 years ago, I worked on the original version of The Sims computer game.
Oh, wow. Many hours spent on that, Eric. I've got you to blame for that.
Yeah. Well, as the time goes on, it's less about angry parents complaining about what I did to their children and more about people saying, hey, thanks for what you did to me. So that's kind of nice.
Yeah. Did you come up with the language by any chance that The Sims used to speak?
No, I did not. but I did implement the cheat system, and Rosebud was one of the cheats I introduced.
Okay, cool. Well, thank you very much for joining us on the show. It's great to have you here. Clearly a fantastic background. So I want to delve into that a little bit, actually, about your most recent experience at TomTom, and that's obviously where I've known you. Why would you argue that TomTom was an IoT business? Is it beyond just what people used to know of TomTom, that was the, you know, personal navigation devices that used to sit on top of cars' dashboards, or does it go further than that?
Yeah, well, I think it certainly starts there. It does go a bit further. The way that I described it really was that TomTom had an Internet of Things business before Internet of Things existed, and they had a flywheel business before people really talked about flywheel businesses. And I think one of the things that really attracted me about what they were doing was how clever all of that was. And in their original devices, or at least early in the devices, they started putting SIM cards in and collecting GPS probe data in a very simple Internet of Things application and uploading that to the server and creating a traffic model, which allowed people to avoid a traffic jam. And I think, you know, as people experienced that for the first time, it was really a kind of hair standing up on the back of your neck moment, like an absolute triumph of product and technology, which led to, you know, tremendous word of mouth spread and huge growth for the company. And of course, that as they sold more of those devices, that data flow, the breadth of it and the depth increased. And so the product improved by adding more customers, which is a wonderful flywheel effect. And, you know, their business is less about those devices these days. They're more of a kind of a B2B business. They do a lot of business with automotive, but they continue to collect that same data. And the traffic model has just gotten better and better and continues to be, you know, a significant challenger, if not outright better than Google's traffic model, at least in my view.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I won't touch on the last comment, but yeah, I think a lot of businesses struggle to know what to do with this data, right? Obviously, you know, IoT devices by their very nature collecting and harvesting data, but it's the interpretation of that and the decisions that can be made from the interpretation of that data, which is so important. And I would imagine a business like TomTom is collecting so much data at all times. What decisions are or have been impacted from the collection of that data that TomTom have used on an enterprise level?
Well, yeah, so you're right about how challenging it is kind of at every layer of the stack. And that has really slowed things down, I think, for a lot of the opportunity that we see out in the market. You know, on a good day, TomTom is somewhere in the 600 to 900 million connected vehicles, which is a ton of data. And increasingly, that data becomes more rich because of another Internet of Things application out there, which is ADAS cameras, where there's a camera that's doing kind of onboard tagging of what the camera is seeing to see signs and lanes and things like that. So that data becomes richer. Ultimately, you know, what becomes possible, and I think what TomTom's really kind of long-term and even maybe medium-term strategy is to use that data to create a much better, fresher and higher quality map based on those data streams that are individually quite rudimentary, but at scale, there's a ton of richness there. But it is a significant technical challenge, algorithmic challenge, to figure out how to get all of the insights out of it. And, you know, the necessary infrastructure is complicated. And while some of the use cases, the data doesn't have to be fresh or very fresh, certainly for a live traffic model, it really needs to be extremely fresh within, you know, minutes to be useful. And so every single part of that challenge is pretty difficult. But, you know, it's, you know, hundreds of millions of people benefit from some understanding of traffic conditions. And when you're driving, even if you don't need navigation, certainly knowing that there is a traffic jam, it almost becomes, you know, the baseline of what people expect. And certainly when it's taken away from you, like in a rental car or something, you really appreciate, like, you know, driving, trying to predict when you get anywhere is pretty difficult without some kind of assistive technology, whether it's on your phone or built into the car or even like a device.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I completely agree. From a consumer point of view, you know, you really are lost without it, right? I actually remember one of the early instances of first using satellite navigation was it was using TomTom's app that I had on an iPad, and using that, it was just transformative for me. You know, yeah. Being able to be, you know, prior to that, you used to print off the Google things on a piece of paper and then somehow try and work it out. So
before that, MapQuest.
Yeah. And before that, a map, right? And yeah, usually exactly. You'd have it upside down. So I remember that fondly. Being in your position, obviously, as a CTO for a technology company, there's a lot of people that watch our podcast that may not be in a similar position, but may have aspirations to reach those kind of ranks within an organization. What kind of skills would you say that people would need to possess to work in a business that's involved in IoT that may be in demand in 2024?
Yeah, I think, I get a similar question pretty often. How do you get to do this? And I guess the first question you should ask yourself is, do you really want to do this? Because it's a very different job than being like a software engineer or a data engineer. And it is a mixed bag. But I would say that, you know, all of the experience. So I worked as an individual contributor into my 40s before I got into management. And I'm quite happy that I remained working as an engineer as long as I did, because it takes time with technology to go deep enough to build up the kind of intuition that you need to really be an effective like technology executive, whether in IoT or otherwise. And, you know, I think the part that I would caution people about is, and what people don't understand is that at a very senior level, the amount of task switching and context switching that you have to do through a day is pretty exhausting and pretty challenging, and not everyone can do it. And certainly very few people can do it very, very well. And one of the things that makes it possible to exist in that is that essentially, you know, your intuition plays a very significant role. So if you're familiar with Thinking Fast and Slow, this quite remarkable book, which written by the inventors of behavioral economics, and it really highlights a lot of cognitive biases and has a nice model for how the brain works. There's what they call system one and system two, and system one is kind of your intuition, and system two is the part where you really have to stop and think. And your intuition doesn't really require much energy, and it can easily multitask, but it's easily fooled. And your system two is single-threaded and exhausting. And so the reason, in my view, to remain technical as long as you can is that you build up more and more intuition, or kind of system one, which makes it possible to more safely task switch between them, you know, the 40 different things that people put on your plate in a given day as a CTO, where you have to understand it enough, both in technology terms and in human terms, to understand what's going on. And you know, when people need guidance, to give it to them, but also avoid giving too much guidance. You know, you got to really create the conditions where people are figuring out for themselves what's the right thing to do. And then, of course, the other element is really it's good to understand people. And for that, it's important to step out of the technology domain somehow. And, you know, I think for me personally, having a family helped me to be, I think, a bit more understanding of people. But I also like to read fiction and even poetry sometimes. Science fiction is also a wonderful source for people to really understand what makes people tick. Because at the end of the day, you know, it's about applying people and technology, whether in IoT or anything that's based in technology, to really understand the problems that people have and how we're going to solve, organize ourselves to solve them using technology. Hmm.
Very well articulated. Yeah. I think one of the things that I love about the technology industry, which resonates in what you said there, is you can be both an individual contributor and do very, very well at that. Or you can take the step into management, and also time isn't necessarily a precursor for impact. So people can be very, very good at what they do by having an affinity with the code or an affinity with the technological aspects and other things you can learn and other things you can bolt on. But it isn't for everyone, right? So I think the phrase, be careful what you wish for, is quite a poignant one, I think.
Yeah, and very often, you know, you don't really know what you're getting into until it's too late. I've been incredibly fortunate in my career that I've very rarely ended up in a situation where I was working on something that I didn't love. And I think that would be the other piece of advice that I would give, you know, to people, is that finding something that you love and then doing that for 10 years and really, you know, assuming that mastering that is important to you, and it's perfectly fine to kind of work to live, you know, as opposed to live to work. But if you really want to master something, then the difference between loving it and not loving it is night and day in terms of how, you know, getting up every day and trying to improve yourself can be a joy or it can be a nightmare.
Well, they say 10,000 hours to master something, right? So you better love it in order to spend 10,000 hours
away. As soon as you have kids, you realize 10,000 hours goes by pretty quickly.
Yeah. Feels like an afternoon, probably.
Yeah.
thank you, Eric. So moving on a little bit more into IoT development specifically. So last year, we obviously saw lots of developments in IoT and a convergence, really, of various technological advancements from edge computing to AI, major cloud providers expanding services, and of course the EU Data Act. What are your thoughts on where we are with IoT at the moment and both the convergence and coalition of different technologies happening at the same time? Pretty interesting time to be involved in tech, I would imagine.
Agreed. Yeah, of course, you know, the last year in terms of large language models and generative AI has been quite literally transformative for many people, and there are amazing things about it and less amazing things about it. And it's not clear how all this is going to shake out, but it has shaken big tech. It has shaken the foundations of every industry as well as the labor market. And exactly what it means for IoT, I think, is a really interesting question and challenge. And I think it's quite possible that it's actually going to be what enables something like an IoT breakthrough in the market. And the reason I think that is that, you know, I think, first of all, one of the real challenges when you're designing an IoT system, you know, in a period in history when technology is moving so fast, is that there's this constant balancing act as kind of an architect between how much smarts or how thick an IoT client should be versus how much bandwidth is it using versus what is the complexity and what are also the privacy issues, for example, and the regulatory environment server side. And there are some patterns, but I think also it's really moving quite fast still. And it just isn't clear yet, in my view, what is the most preferred way for any given situation, let alone lots of different situations. So it's a very fluid technical environment, which makes it both interesting and scary. Scary because it's very easy to build something that's actually not going to be fit for purpose or not going to scale the way that you like. And of course, you know, it distributed systems are hard, and IoT systems are about as distributed as it gets. So every single part of the problem is difficult. And then I think, you know, the second factor that's sort of interesting is that there's so much economic pressure on reducing the power consumption of different approaches to AI, including large language models. And the driver for that is not necessarily IoT itself. It's more about just general power consumption in data centers. But IoT is very likely to benefit from that. And, you know, the kind of scale of compute now that is needed for modern data center AI application is so enormous that we can foresee that really quite sophisticated applications are going to be possible quite soon in a more embedded or IoT environment. And they are very likely to be able to run in a reasonable way for lots of relevant tasks without needing to make network calls to do so. And so that opens up a possibility space that was almost unimaginable, you know, even 2 years ago. So there's quite a lot still to be figured out. And we're waiting for some of what I said to come true. But it is, in my view, foreseeable and something that we can start to plan and design around. And then the question really becomes, well, so what is the smarts that is needed at the edge of the network? What is the purpose of having AI in IoT? And I think, you know, there are a few kind of obvious things around being able to tag data and significantly reducing, for example, the bandwidth requirements for, you know, transmitting quite rich data sets over a fairly expensive and potentially slow and high latency network connection. But where I think it could become really quite interesting is as IoT devices themselves become much more capable of interacting directly with people. And that, you know, so far what we've seen there has been pretty disappointing. I think the kind of big tech entrance in terms of interactivity in the home did not change the world. And now actually, you know, since the release of GPT 3.5 are almost awkward, embarrassed, and embarrassing to use. But as that changes, I think there's a bunch of applications that become possible. And, you know, I go back to, I can't remember what it's called, but Amazon had this thing where, you know, if you liked some particular detergent, they'd give you basically a big red button to press when you wanted to order that detergent.
Yes, I remember.
Doesn't strike me as like a total winner of a product, but they're, you know, they're experimenting and seeing what works. But they are, you know, they were trying to solve a real problem there. And I think those kinds of problems are going to become solvable, and the combination of IoT and AI in particular, and as very small devices become capable of interacting with us and also maintaining some understanding of our identity, there will emerge a level of convenience that I think is, I mean, essentially almost unimaginable at this point. You know, even just as 20 years ago, you could imagine what people are using their phones for. I think it's very likely that world is going to displace the need for phones. And you know, I think phones will rapidly, after a certain set of innovations, become at least irrelevant in more cases. Like, I don't think we'll use phones around the house like we do now. I don't know about you and your family, but if I, any given moment of any given day, someone is doing something on a phone at my house, and I'd be pretty happy. And there, and some of that is really quite useful stuff. So that's a little bit of what I'm thinking about in that space.
Yeah, it's interesting insights. I remember that Amazon button. I used to think, you know, this is a bit overkill, right? I've forgotten what it's called as well, but I think the premise was you could put the detergent in the kind of laundry room, stick a button on the wall, and when you were low, you could hit the button. But of course, now Amazon just tell you if, on your Alexa device every 5 minutes you might be running low, and you've only got to say the wrong thing slightly, and you've ordered two ton of it.
Yeah, they're backing the truck up to your house.
Yeah. So, but no, I think that's a really interesting point. You know, but you know, and that wasn't so long ago, right? That was what, a year, 2-3 years, maybe.
I think it was a little longer than that, pre-pandemic for sure.
Right. But relatively speaking, not long ago. To now getting to the point where, you know, the AI could start to converse, right? And we've had people talk about cobots on the podcast and robotics coming into the industry and actually working alongside people really, really well. But actually now, if you take that other dimension of being able to converse and or think for itself based upon the data that's coming, it starts to get quite spicy and quite interesting, actually.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so I can't quite imagine exactly where this is all going to go. And, you know, you can kind of have sort of guesses about how quickly, but yeah. I don't think anyone would have realized how quickly NVIDIA's market cap would go up, you know, and where it was from 10 years ago. So, and that never ceases to amaze me in this industry.
It's amazing. I think it's moving now faster than it's ever moved. And, what a time to be alive. Amazing and terrifying all at the same time.
Yeah. Just gotta hope it's slightly more amazing than terrifying. Yeah. So it's an interesting point to talk there about the interaction and the typical use cases for that. So one that we were involved with as a business many years ago, and that people should do well to remember is actually in care. So when you have people who, you know, maybe at home or they're not getting regular visits or, you know, they're quite elderly, actually this IoT and these sensors and the ability to interact with those people and to provide them some level of comfort, right, when they're spending the vast majority of time alone is actually a really, really feel-good factor. And I think, you know, that's some of the great things that we have about the technology that go beyond, say, you know, the commercial gain of being able to sell more washing detergent, right? I can't wait to see this improve. And I think we're going to make terrific strides, you know, very, very quickly. When we're talking about at the edge and, you know, things like tiny ML, you know, and what that's doing to devices right now, right?
Yeah, and SML, small language models.
Yes.
That reminds me of a story I heard once about someone on the Alexa team who gave his father, who was aging, an early Alexa, and then was able, after he passed away, to download the recordings of this development device. And you know, it was kind of eye-opening for the whole team to hear how he was interacting with this device, you know, essentially for company.
Yes.
That, you know, I think a lot of the history of IoT is that these are very, you know, barely capable devices out there that are simply collecting data for, you know, some kind of central brain, if you will. And in and even though the optimistic promise of that much observability is really exciting, very different as we start to think about more capability on the edge. And both in terms of you know, what's possible in terms of human interaction, as we've talked about, but also, you know, you mentioned care and the you know, the, I don't know if you know what a RAG or request augmented generation is, but it's essentially working with a large language model, you can kind of really load up the prompt with a ton of context. And right. as we get smaller language models deployed, certainly one of the really interesting things that's going to happen is we'll see request augmented generation using all of the local data in a way that's against a local model, in a way that's very privacy, you know, safe. No data will be leaving the device, and it will be possible to do all kinds of things, you know, including, I think, dramatic improvements in healthcare for much less cost all over the world. Also almost certainly, you know, mining people's kind of mental state and as well as, energy efficiency in the home. And I mean, it's like, it is mind blowing what's possible, and how we choose as a society to prioritize that will be kind of interesting to see how it shakes out.
Do you think there's, do you think there's a risk or a potential with AI and general security when it comes to protection of people's data and what can be harvested from IoT? Or is it?
Yes, I do.
I'm glad I asked.
No, it's always a risk, you know. And I really salute the European Union for the strides that it's taken, and then that set a good model for the rest of the world. But it is, you know, and actually, you know, the way GDPR is structured is sort of telling about what is the dilemma that people and companies will continue to face, which is that everything is kind of the trade-off between privacy and the unintended consequences of giving up privacy relative to the benefits of, you know, essentially one person's privacy is kind of another person's context container for insights and learning and creating value. And it's, you know, these are tools that can be used for good or ill. And, you know, I think it's one sign of what's to come is going on now in the lawsuit. The New York Times is filing against OpenAI, where, you know, they feel rightly or wrongly that OpenAI was perhaps a little too liberal in its use of their data. And of course, it's not individual data, but it's just difficult, especially for, you know, product developers trying to do good in the world. The value that they can create from using this data to derive insights is to them non-ambiguous. And it's unfortunately complicated to think through all the privacy implications. So there will be mistakes, and legislation will be tailing. But I suspect that it will over time kind of work itself out, hopefully without too many problems.
Yeah, fingers crossed. It's fantastic insights. I think, you know, one thing we haven't even touched on, you know, in all of this is the injection of quantum into this as well, right? So we're talking about the leap of AI. We've got quantum computing obviously growing at a rapid pace as well. IoT actually now, you know, doing its thing and not being theoretical anymore. So, you know, it is really a fantastic time to be alive. And it's certainly within technology, the pace of innovation is quite hard to keep up, actually, isn't it? You know,
I'm a little more skeptical about quantum.
Okay. I'll be interested to know why.
I think, now on the one hand, I mean, obviously full scale quantum is kind of scary because it will render much of the encrypted data in the world, currently in the world, unencrypted, essentially. And the consequences of that are a little scary, although I know, I just saw the headline, I think today or yesterday, that Apple's messaging product is using a new encryption algorithm, which they think is more safe from quantum computing attacks. But I think quantum is still quite a ways off, personally. And I could be wrong. And I'm certainly not an expert, but I have been listening for 30 years, people talking about that it's almost here. And it doesn't really seem to be here yet, despite some claims to the contrary.
Mm. I agree with you in the sense of the fundamental shift from binary on and off to being the same time in a super state, and that whole reworking of everything that we ever knew and were trained about how a system works. It's not something that can be done very quickly or necessarily be developed and deployed in a safe manner quickly, which is why it's probably taken so long to get to where it's got to today. And it hasn't actually got that very far, has it?
Not so far. But and it is, you know, it's a very, very different programming model. But if you, you know, the appeal of it is real, in part because if you ascribe to the mini world's interpretation of quantum mechanics, you know, it is literally utilizing compute from essentially an infinite number of universes in parallel. And unlocking that capability is, you know, if we think AI is cool, unlocking that will be a whole nother. I mean, it is quite unimaginable for most people what kinds of problems could become solvable.
All created.
And created. Yes. But the good news is I think we have a minute before we're there.
Yeah, just about. Eric, thank you so much for coming on to the IoT podcast. It's been really interesting to hear your thoughts on a variety of topics. I think, you know, we could probably talk for hours and hours about various elements of IoT and different technologies coming into play at the moment. But I think it's been really, really insightful and definitely for our listeners to hear it from a slightly different perspective, actually, and someone that can take a more wider view of where we are today. As we come to the end of the show, we always ask a series of questions and some wrap-up questions. And the question that we've got for you today, Eric, is a fairly vanilla one, but an interesting one. What challenge that you face in the kind of everyday life would you like to see a tech solution for, whatever it may well be?
Yeah, that's a good one. What I face in my role, you know, is a constant stream of requests, follow-ups, and contacts to be organized. And I am starting another job very soon, a new job, but I was tempted to pursue this as a startup. And it's essentially a combination of email and to-do and calendar and personal database that's backed by AI. And, you know, the tools that we use today are so rudimentary compared to what is possible. I have built some prototypes using scripting and specific tools that are open to scripting, and I've started to get a taste of what that can be like. And I want more of it. I don't want to have to build it myself. And I definitely want all the people who I work with to have that. And it would really mean much more rapid access to contextual information that's helpful, and a much easier way to make sure that follow-ups happen, that agreements are kept, and context is shared. And essentially, it's enabling, you know, a group of people to remain focused on a bigger goal rather than getting kind of distracted and fragmented. And that for me is something the world really, really needs and just does not have.
Yeah, I can completely agree. I mean, we have when we have meetings in our business, we have a mobile phone in a bowl policy. The distraction that people have is palpable, right? I mean, I personally use a series of reminders all the time, because I've got a pretty good memory, actually, but if I don't have these reminders, it just doesn't get done.
Yeah.
But you need something to combine. And yeah, you're right. It is actually quite rudimentary. So, if you ever end up doing that, I'll be watching with real interest. I might even invest something as well. And some quick fire questions. So a gadget that you can't live without, Eric?
It's probably my Peloton.
Oh, nice. Okay. Is that the bike or the treadmill?
Bike, yeah.
Okay, nice.
Love it.
Most unexpected thing that you've learned this week, and it is a Thursday, so you've had a few days to learn something.
I think there was a study that was just published by Harvard Business School around innovation and joy and compensation. It's not an entirely new idea. Dan Pink talks about this in Drive, that money is often a poor motivator. But this study, which they did using people contributing to GitHub, was incredibly comprehensive and absolutely conclusive that people are much more innovative and creative when they're motivated by some kind of internal sense of joy than any amount of money. And even though I wouldn't say I didn't know that, I did know about the study, and it really kind of, I don't know, made me happy.
Hmm. Reminds me of a book by Ken Blanchard. I think it's Gung Ho, where he uses Albert Einstein's theory of relativity to say enthusiasm is motivation and cash combined. I think it is something like that, right?
Yeah.
So, it's joy. Cash and congratulations. So it's a similar type of topic, actually. So yeah,
big fan of Ken Blanchard.
Yes, say. Very good. Yeah, very good. Yeah, 1 Minute Manager, great book. And something that you're passionate about outside of work, Eric.
I think that would have to be my family. Certainly, the pandemic brought us together in a way. Honestly, when it started, I was worried we were all going to kill each other. And it allowed me to connect with my kids and my wife in a way that hadn't previously. And that has been really become quite a passion. It's amazing to see that develop. And something about family and the bonds that in the modern world, especially coming from the U.S. as I do, it's very often minimized. And yet a lot of research has shown that those kind of connections are key to happiness. And I think as boring as that actually may be in a way, that's what I'm most passionate about at this point.
Oh, it's incredibly heartfelt and lovely. And what a way to end the show. Eric, thank you so much for coming on to the IoT podcast.
Thanks, Tom. It's a real pleasure.